Chapter 14, Chapter 10, Georgia in the Royal Period. Chapter Preview, Terms, French and Indian War, Parish, Vestry, Seed, Naval Stores, Cash Crop, Head Right System, Tutor, Immigrant, Cracker, Profit, Slave Code, Denomination. People, John Reynolds, Henry Ellis, James Wright, Puritans, Quakers, Scots-Irish, Bartholomew Zauberbühler, Places, Midway, Sunbury. Becoming a royal colony brought many changes to Georgia, most of them positive. Georgia was the last colony to be turned over to the royal government. In the years that Georgia was under the king and his appointed governors, the colony also had its first representative assemblies. The colony's population grew and its economy prospered. The land available for settlement expanded as the royal governor made two important treaties with the Indians. It was also a period of cultural growth as institutions for education, religion, and social life were established, although on a limited scale. On the other hand, this was also the era that saw the first slave laws and the entrenchment of the plantation system that would have a devastating effect on men and women of African heritage. Page 216, Section 1, Government in Royal Georgia. As you read, look for Georgia's first legislature, Georgia's royal governors, the French and Indian War, the Treaty of Augusta, terms, French and Indian War, parish, vestry, seed. Government in Georgia was quite different after the trustee period ended. The executive of the colony was a royal governor appointed by the king. He was the king's representative to the colony and the colony's representative to the king. When the trustees gave up their charter to the king, Georgia no longer had that document to serve as a framework for government. Instead, each royal governor arrived with instructions from the king, which set the rules under which he would govern Georgia. The royal governor had many powers, including the right to call the legislature into session or to dismiss it, to grant land, to commission ships, to pardon those convicted of crimes, to spend funds, and to serve as commander-in-chief of the colony. The royal government also included a 12-member council officially appointed by the king. The men chosen were prominent local leaders like merchant James Habersham, surveyor Noble Jones, and planter Jonathan Bryan. This governor's council, in addition to advising the governor, also served as the upper house of the bicameral, two-house, legislature. As such, it could propose and vote on laws. The council, along with the governor, was also the supreme court of the colony. For the first time, the colony was to have an elected assembly called the Commons House of Assembly. This would be the lower house of the legislature, similar to today's House of Representatives. This body could also propose and vote on laws. Only the lower house could initiate, be the first to introduce, bills that pertained to money. To be eligible for the assembly, one had to be a free white man who owned at least 500 acres of land. To vote for the representatives to the assembly, a person had to be a free white man who owned no less than 50 acres of land. The first assembly had 19 members elected from the settled areas of Georgia. Although many could not vote or hold an elected office, this assembly gave Georgians far more power than they had during the trustee years. John Reynolds. On October 29, 1754, the first royal governor appointed by King George II arrived from England. A former Navy captain, John Reynolds, got a hearty welcome in Savannah, with bells ringing and guns saluting him. The colonists were happy to have a new beginning and thought they would live better under a royal government. The governor met with his council that November. Although the council house on what today is Wright Square was a large structure, it was also decaying. In the very first meeting, part of the building fell in. So under the direction of Noble Jones, a sturdier structure was built. The French and Indian War. The year that Governor Reynolds came to Georgia was also the year that the conflict known in the colonies as the French and Indian War began in the Ohio River Valley far north of Georgia. It started as a struggle between Great Britain and France for the land west of the Appalachian Mountains. The French claimed the land and had Indian allies in the area. They had built a string of forts, one of which, Fort Duquesne, was located where the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers flow together to form the Great Ohio River. This is now the site of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. As Virginia's population had grown, that colony wanted to expand over the mountains into the same area. The Virginia governor sent a young Virginian named George Washington into the area to survey it and build a fort. He was met by resistance from the French. In the battle, the French killed many of his men, and Washington returned to the governor with a message from the French that the territory was theirs. In 1755, the British sent a regiment of British and American soldiers to challenge that claim. When they returned to the disputed land, the French defeated them and killed their commander, General Braddock. The next year, the war between Great Britain and France and their colonists expanded out of North America and into Europe, where it was known as the Seven Years' War. While Georgians had nothing to do with the beginning of this war, they feared that it would spread to them. On Georgia's far western frontier, near the Mississippi River, were the Choctaw Indians who traded with the French. On the western and northern edge of the colony were the Creek and Cherokee. The Georgians feared they too might ally with the French. To the south were the Spanish, who eventually did come into the war on the side of the French. Georgia had to plan for its defense in case the war came to its borders. One of the first laws passed by the new assembly in January 1755 was the Militia Act. All males ages 16 to 60 had to enroll in the militia. If the colony went to war, Georgia would be protected by its citizen soldiers. Governor Reynolds pushed for new forts for Georgia. He hired engineer William G. DeBrom, who was working in South Carolina, to design a plan for Georgia's defense. DeBrom drew up plans for forts and cannons along Georgia's borders. But Governor Reynolds could not get the council to agree to pay for these defenses with higher taxes. The British government would not pay for them either. A tense time. The governor tried to run the colony like the military. He did not work well with the leading citizens and tried to exercise control as he did when he was an officer in the Navy. An angry Governor Reynolds dismissed the council and assembly whenever they did not do what he wanted. Increasingly, he relied on his closest aide and advisor, William Little, and did not consult with the council. This led to even more resentment from many of the people, and the governor became more and more unpopular. By March 1756, the council asked the Board of Trade, the British governing group that oversaw the colonies, to remove the governor. In 1757, with the war still ongoing, Reynolds left the colony. His major impact had been his efforts to increase defense and the conflict that he had caused between those who supported him and those who did not. Henry Ellis. In February 1757, the newly appointed Henry Ellis arrived to a cheering crowd in Savannah. Ellis was surprised at how bad some of the conditions in Georgia were. Buildings, most of them made of wood, were in disrepair. The colony badly needed defenses, and the people were, he said, exceedingly dissatisfied with each other. A capable leader, Ellis set about to work with Georgians to improve the colony, and he soon became very popular with all Georgia groups. With the advice of Engineer DeBrom, Ellis ordered that forts be built, including a palisade around Savannah. Ellis worried about the loyalty of the Indians on Georgia's borders. In late 1757, after the Savannah fortifications were completed, he invited some of the Micos, or head men, of the Indians to Savannah. They were greeted with a display of the cannons and a musket salute from the militia. There is no way to know if this military show impressed them, but the meeting was a great success. The Indians made an agreement with the Georgians during this meeting that renewed their pledges of friendship. Ellis had other accomplishments besides his defense buildup. In March 1758, Georgia was divided into 8 parishes, which were both government and religious districts. After that, representatives to the assembly were elected from their parishes. Each parish also had a vestry, which served as a local governing board. The vestry could levy taxes, provide charity for the poor, maintain roads, and oversee churches. The Church of England, the Anglican Church, became the official or established church in the colony, although other religions were still allowed to worship. Taxes, however, could be used for the Anglican Church and its ministers. The parish in and around Savannah was Christ Church Parish, with the other parishes named for various saints. These changes brought order and organization to Georgia's local areas. Despite his popularity, Henry Ellis only stayed in Georgia 3 years. He found the heat and humidity too difficult. In fact, he walked around Savannah holding an umbrella with a thermometer hanging from the handle and complained that the climate was bad for his health. He asked the Board of Trade to relieve him so he could come home for health reasons. Even though he did not stay very long, he had a positive impact on Georgia. By the time he left, Georgians were better defended, doing better economically, and were happier. James Wright. Before he left in 1760, Ellis welcomed the third and final royal governor to the colony, 44-year-old James Wright. Wright was a very good leader for Georgia. Although he had been raised in England, he had spent much of his adult life in South Carolina, so he understood the colonies and was used to the southern climate. He had experience working in government as South Carolina's Attorney General. In addition, Wright truly cared about the colony and wanted it to be successful. He worked hard to make sure that Georgia grew in population and wealth. He made Georgia his home and planned to live there for the rest of his life. Wright himself became personally successful. He eventually had 11 plantations and over 25,000 acres of land. Fortunately for Wright and for Georgia, the French and Indian War ended with a British victory. The Treaty of Paris, signed in 1763, benefited the young Georgia colony. A treaty is a formal agreement between two or more nations. According to its terms, Spain gave up Florida to the British. France gave up its North American lands. Great Britain received Canada and all French land east of the Mississippi River. Although it gave up Florida, Spain received the land west of the Mississippi River. So Georgia's borders now extended to the Mississippi River, not the Pacific Ocean. Georgia had also been lucky in the war, for the feared invasions from France or Spain never happened. The Cherokee Indians had attacked in South Carolina, and fears that they might attack farmers in the backcountry of Georgia had led many settlers to come to Augusta for safety. With the war over, Governor Wright wanted to ensure good relations with the Indians. In 1763, he arranged a large meeting in Augusta, attended by the Royal Indian Superintendent, John Stuart, the governors of 4 southern colonies, and the Creek and Cherokee Indians. There they negotiated the important Treaty of Augusta. The Indians agreed to cede, to surrender, to the Georgia colony all the land between the Ogeechee and the Savannah Rivers north to Little River, which is now the dividing line between Columbia and Lincoln counties. This was the land west and northwest of Augusta. The Indians also gave up the coastal land between the Altamaha and St. Mary's Rivers. This treaty opened up well over 3 million acres for settlement and led to the creation of 4 new parishes. 10 years later, a final treaty was negotiated in which Georgia agreed to pay debts that the Creek and the Cherokee owed to traders. In return, the colony acquired over 2 million acres of land. The largest portion of this land was north of Little River and in the west from a line connecting the South Fork of the Broad River with the headwaters of the Ogeechee River. This opened up vast new lands for settlement, although Wright's plan was to sell this land to raise the money to pay the debts to the Indian traders. Georgia's relations with the Indians remained mostly peaceful. Reviewing the section. 1. Define French and Indian War, Parrish. 2. Name Georgia's 3 royal governors. 3. Why do you think there were land ownership requirements to run for the assembly or to vote for those running? Page 225, Discovering Georgia's Past. Mary Musgrove and her land claims. During the trustee period, Mary Musgrove had been an invaluable aide to the young Georgia colony, serving as an interpreter and a diplomat. As the daughter of an English trader and an Indian mother, she was able to bridge the two worlds. Her mother was sister to the Creek leader, Brim. After he died, her cousin, Malachi, became an important Miko. In the original agreement between Oglethorpe and Tomochichi, the Indians had allowed the British to settle along the coast. They had reserved for themselves their tract near Savannah on 3 islands, Osaba, St. Catharines, and Sapelo. In 1737, Tomochichi had granted Mary land near Savannah. Several years later, Malachi gave Mary the 3 islands belonging to the Creek. However, the trustees and the British government refused to recognize the Indians' right to grant land to individuals. Mary believed that she had never been adequately rewarded for her services to the British. When he left in 1743, Oglethorpe had given Mary a diamond ring and promised that she would be rewarded for her efforts on the colony's behalf. When that did not happen, Mary and her 3rd husband, Anglican minister Thomas Buzzleworth, began to push to have her claims recognized. In July 1749, over 200 Creek, led by Malachi, visited Savannah for a month to argue for Mary's claims. In 1754, Mary and her husband went to London to present her case to the British government. The government referred the issue to the Georgia courts. While Mary was in England, the authorities in Georgia made an agreement with some of the Creek towns to sell the disputed land to the British. Malachi, however, did not agree to this. When Henry Ellis became the royal governor, the dispute had still not been resolved. Governor Ellis proposed a settlement. Mary would receive St. Catharines Island, where she lived, and a sum of money from the proceeds of the sale of Osaba and Sapelo Islands. The British government agreed to the compromise. In 1760, Mary signed an agreement giving up the other 2 islands. The governor then signed a grant for the 6,200 acres of St. Catharines Island.